Greetings from K9 to diddly-dum, diddly-dum, diddly-dum. End of message.
Faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 128 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Delta Cubed Sigma Chi Squared podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
I'm Mark.
Well, here we all are at the Diddly Dum Museum, and as we mentioned on our last podcast, for the third year running, the Doctor Who Appreciation Society has completely lost its mind and named us as the official podcasters of their Capitol Convention. This year, they've also asked us to be the official podcasters of their Terence Dix, a celebration event on Sunday the 15th of March. And to tell us more about this event, we're being joined today at the Diddly Dum Museum by DWAS head honcho, Tony Jordan. Partly because of his standing as a good friend of the podcast, although that standing may be rapidly coming to a conclusion, but mainly because his demands meant that we couldn't book Paul as my will so mote it be winter, the DWAS coordinator. Now, as Tony's motorcade wends its way from Mummerset International Airport, a massive security operation is surrounding his convoy of Zill party limousines. Waiting his arrival outside the Hooseum, Biscuit Factory Square has been sealed off tighter than Hayden's wallet. We've got armoured cars and tanks and jeeps. We've got bears from wall to wall. In fact, we've even had to call in some reinforcements from the Mummerset National Guard. And if you look up, circling high above the square in the Diddly Dum blimp, we've even got a bear in the air.
Oh, hello.
How naughty you are, staring out of the window like that. It's very rude.
Oh. Is that the War Bungle?
Yes, he's our new security chief. We've even taken the security precaution of hosting Tony's visit down here in the bomb-proof vaults, which stretch under our private graveyard behind the Hooseum. So, how are you feeling in anticipation of Tony's visit, boys? Are you excited, Mark?
Yep, I've got a reefer on.
Oh, hang on, that sounds like a vehicle pulling up outside the main entrance. Hello, Rubber Bear, Rubber Bear. Is that Mr. Jordan's limo? Okay, no false alarm, boys. It's just 11 long-haired friends of Jesus in a Chartreuse microbus.
Really? I wasn't aware that the Flight Through Entirety podcasters were in the country.
Well, seems so. Convoy's taking its time, isn't it? Have you heard that rumour that the motorcade is actually a diversion and that Tony's going to be making his way here on foot? Hang on. You hear that tapping overhead?
Just...
If I'm not much mistaken, that sounds very much like someone tapping on the tombstone of Sir Jasper Gribble, 10th Baronet, founder of the Naughty Hellfire Club, died at the age of 97 in the arms of his fifth wife, and tapping with a mahogany gentleman's sword stick at that. Sounds like there's a mahogany gentleman up there waiting to use our secret graveyard lift. Either that or Hayden's watched Live and Let Die too many times. Mark, would you operate the lift machinery, please?
Certainly.
That's coming down now. Oh, it's got stuck halfway. Can you see anything, boys?
Not clearly.
All I can see is someone in a bath chair with a plaster cast on his foot. Can you read any of the writing on the cast? Hope you're back on your feet soon, Ian Levine.
Oh, okay.
Everton for the Cup, Sheldon. Have you got any spare Capitol tickets, Andrew? All right, give the machinery a kick, Mark, would you? It it's Mr. Jordan himself.
Hey.
Welcome, Tony.
Hello.
Woo. Now, to mark the special occasion, I've been down to the cellars and brought up a nice bottle for us to share. Look at that. 1974 vintage. Hold your glasses out, boys. Ah, Dandelion and Burdock. The impossible dream of a thousand alchemists dripping like tea from an urn. Don Antonio, how are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. Did you know that Dandelion and Burdock was the unreleased Oasis follow-up to Cigarettes and Alcohol? Think how Britpop would have gone if that was the case.
It certainly would have been a little less abrasive, but there you go.
Who said that? Is Damon Albarn in the building?
There you go. I'm all right, thank you, gentlemen. Nice to be back.
Nice to have you back. Nice to have you back. How's things at the Dwas? Are wheels, cogs turning within cogs, wheels turning within wheels as ever?
Yeah, never-ending spinning wheels, like whatever it is you find in the windmills of my mind. My mind is very strange. Yeah, it's busy. It's busy because we've got Uncle Terence's event coming up very soon. And obviously, this is a very strange scenario in that we're not the sole organisers. We're co-organising it with Steve Hatcher's Hoovers. So it's a bit of a group effort, as it were. And it's a pretty blank canvas. It's not. He knows how he does his things. I know how I do my things. And this is going to be a bit different. Well, it's going to be very different. It's going to be a unique one-off. So I'm really not sure what's going to happen. Well, I know what's going to happen on the day, roughly, but can't sort of guarantee it'll all run quite as smoothly as normal. But there we go.
So I know, but just in case any of our listeners don't, who are the Hoovers?
They are a very long-running group of fans based in Derby. They organise Big Finish Day nowadays on behalf of Nick Briggs and Jason Hay-Galleray. And they have their own one-day annual convention called Hooverville, which I think this year will be their 11th. And they have, guest meetings every so often. So they're very long-standing, well-organised group in the East Midlands.
We lost Uncle Terence, of course, in August last year. So how did this first come about, this event, then, Tony?
Well, Terence's death wasn't announced until the beginning of September. And then probably a few days later, out of the blue, an email came from Paul Cornell to myself and Steve Hatcher. Paul had a good relationship with Terence. They met every so often. And Paul had been to lunch with Elsa, Terence's widow, and they were discussing things, how best to celebrate Terence's life. And he suggested that myself and Steve, on behalf of the Dwas and Hoovers, could organise something in due course in the new year. What happened was that there was a family memorial for Terence towards the end of October, to which we were both invited. It really was genuinely just a family thing. There were no big names or anything there, which was lovely. And we got to know the family better then, and we've taken it from there. So it was quite a lot of hard work finding a location that would work within the time frame. We needed to get it done before Easter, basically, but we couldn't do it in January and February because of potential weather issues. So Marcus Hearn, the editor of DWM, was at Terence's memorial. We were discussing various things. I said possibility of maybe Riverside Studios, but they're not fully open yet. And Marcus has connections with the Cinema Museum in Lambeth, and he suggested he could contact them, and he did. And in due course, we came to an agreement with Martin Humphreys at the Cinema Museum, and they are giving us the venue free of charge for the 15th of March, which is fantastic.
Wow.
Which means that we sold all 125 tickets within about 3 weeks. That's £40 a pop, so that's £5,000 for Save the Children before we even start, which is absolutely lovely.
And that was Terence's preferred charity, wasn't it?
Save the Children, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So the family did a Just Giving thing after he died, and that raised £3,000 or more. We're going to raise more than the £5,000, I hope, because we are going to charge for autographs. And it was Terence's passion for Save the Children was because of his passion for the literacy of children. He wanted to make sure that every child has a chance to learn to read properly and to appreciate the beauty of prose. And I think that's very worthy that we support that for this special event. Okay, I'm far too serious here, aren't I?
You've got some quite notable guests coming as well, haven't you, who have a history within the literary world, and especially the Doctor Who world within that too. One of the ones that jumped out at me is Peter Darville Evans, who I think was the editor, was it Virgin back in the 90s?
Yep, we have Peter. And we have Nigel Robinson. Right. Levine had confirmed, but she might not be able to make it now. But certainly one of the panels is going to, I would like it to be called the editor's editor, because Terence was the ultimate script editor, but these were his editors when he was writing. And it'll be really interesting to see what people made of editing Terence's work.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, exactly. I think you need to come at this event from slightly out in left field in terms of how we're going to set it up. Clearly, one of the big names we have is Stephen Moffat. Delighted Stephen's coming.
Stephen Moffat.
Did a kids show called Press Gang long ago.
Oh, of course. Yes.
Yeah, that's the one.
The bloke from Coupling. Okay, yeah, got it.
That's it. It's going to be interesting to have him on a panel where basically we're looking at the legacy of Terence's writing and what the legacy was on people who have gone on to have careers as writers. Then we're going to have a panel which looked at actors who worked under Terence as script editor or whatever. So you've got Fraser Hines, Katie Manning, Richard Franklin. In particular, Fraser, he worked with obviously towards the end of the sixth series, but he was involved. Terence was very much involved. I know Barry cast Katie and Richard, but Terence was right there at the time. And so it's all about Terence, and it's all about his family, and it's all about his legacy. It's all about what he did to encourage and influence people. I'm sure there's loads of great stories that we're going to hear as well. And there's plenty of other people coming as well. And I phoned John Culshaw back in November, December, and he's ever so keen. He's got a gig in Plymouth the night before, but he's making sure he comes back up, and he's got something very, very special that Neff Fountain and him are writing. And I can't say any more than that, but it should be something very special indeed. Because you know that John was a huge fan of Terence, and they appeared on a panel together at the Capitol too in 2017.
Of course, yes. The panel that if Hayden hadn't been moving house, he would have chaired.
You could have said that John Culshaw would have been the third most convincing Terence Dix impressionist on the stage at that point. But unfortunately, I couldn't make it.
People would have been saying, gosh, doesn't Terence look young?
I tell you one thing, Culshaw is a... You phoned him. I phoned him last week. And he was on a train going somewhere. Having a 10 or 15 minute conversation with John Culshaw blows your mind because you speak about 20 different people.
So how long have you been concerned about Mr. Culshaw, Tony?
Concerned? Oh, well, I've just... he's... Impressionists tend to do that, don't they? Because the great impressionists are not necessarily so confident as their own people. It's like the great comedians they put on a run. Mike Yarwood was a massive name in the 70s and into the 80s.
Mm.
And he did it at the end of his TV show. You say, and this is me. But him as a person was just almost a blank canvas. It was all the people he impersonated. And Alistair McGowan, he would be another one. Jan Ravens would be another one. You know, the real John Culshaw probably is known by his wife and his very close friends.
Yeah.
Although I've met him before, obviously, and I love him. He's a great guy, and his enthusiasm for doing this is splendid, and I'm really pleased about it.
She was on, what did I hear her recently? Oh, Jan Ravens was on, a couple of weeks ago, was on Private Passions on Radio 3, and that was absolutely fascinating. Interestingly, on it's Monday today. On Saturday, I was recording an appearance on Rob Irwin's Doctor Who Show podcast. He forced me at gunpoint to read out complimentary emails that people had sent into his show saying I wondered what his podcast was. So every now and again, I'd get to a point where I'd stop reading out what the reader had said and I wanted to comment on it. And I'd just say, oh, and this is me.
There you go.
And every time I did it, I was thinking, God, do I sound like Mike Yarwood there?
And this is me.
That podcast is out now, by the way. You can find it at thedwshow.net. It's the podcast that's dated February the 23rd.
Rory Bremner was another one by that, wasn't he? Rory Bremner, he did all the voices and the faces and whatever. So that's how it is. Can I now swing right off topic? You mentioned you have a Hellfire Club down in Mummerset. Is that correct?
Well, it's had to move location several times as the police have tried to track it down. Of course, the baronetcy became extinct between the wars, but it's still going well.
Ah, you see, I'm a regular at the one in West Wickham, the original Hellfire Club, you know, so I know what to expect.
Oh, excellent. Well, ours is a pop-up one. So you never know when it's going to spring up, but we'll let you know when it's happening.
So who have we got? We've got Nick Briggs, Paul Cornell. Who was it who wrote that? I think we read it out on the podcast, didn't you, when Terence left us. Someone writing about going to interview him for a school magazine or something when they were
Oh,
a kid.
That was Rob Shearman, wasn't it?
That was it.
Yeah, Rob's coming along. Nick Briggs, Jenny Colgan, Edward Russell will be coming along because he's flying back to Australia.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes a Spider-Man. Is he...
Marcus Hearn?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Marcus and Nick, they'll be doing a panel, and we're still finalising the plans. It is, it's not like we've got rough ideas. I've sent some ideas across to Steve. It's just a question of finalising it. But the Dix family should be along, hopefully Elsa and the three boys. Also, Barry Letts' son and daughter should be joining us as well.
Oh, that'd be brilliant.
They were at the family memorial, and I've asked Crispin if they will kindly read a tribute out that they did back then in October, because it was great and it was interesting perception, because obviously Barry and Terence were like a double act, weren't they?
Yeah.
So it would be really good to have them there as well. So we'll see. It'll be different. It's not a massive high profile event with 28 companions and this and that and the other. It's passionate, and it's about remembering Terence. He is the sole focus of it. I'm certainly going to be, and I know this has come as a surprise, I'm certainly going to be keeping a very low profile. We've got Toby Hadoak is one of the interviewers as well. So we're trying to very much leave it to the pros to run it. And we'll just sit behind and, you know, behind the scenes, and then hopefully be there to pick up anything that doesn't go right.
So is it going to be a series of panels then? Are they going to be going on from each other, or not like a convention where sometimes you choose between one or the other?
No. Because of the nature of the cinema museum, it's all going to be, it's probably not like you would imagine. So it's all going to be organised, and we're hoping to show a video when people first come in from Hooverville, a couple of panels, then a break with autographs. And then I'm hoping, I have discussed it with Keith Barnthar, I'm hoping we'll be able to show Mythmakers 25, which is Barry and Terence together. He has agreed to it. I just need to get it from him while autographs continue and whatever. And then more panels. And then we're going to have an open mic time, and we're going to have a few other bits. So, yeah, it'll be properly structured. It won't be completely hobbledehoy. The Cinema Museum is a fascinating place, though. And I'm going to urge everyone who's there to take an opportunity to just see what is there. Have a look around. There's a very large steel construct silhouette of Charlie Chaplin in there. This is the Lambeth Workhouse where he was sent as a child of 6 or 7. This is the actual location where he was.
Wow.
Yeah. Therefore, it has a fantastic significance. And Martin and Ron have been collecting memorabilia and paraphernalia for 25 years there. It's an extraordinary place. It's well known in the business. There's quite a lot of parties are held there and things like that. It's highly regarded.
They've encased him in what?
Encased who in what?
Charlie Chaplin.
There's a massive steel silhouette of him.
Oh, silhouette. Got you, okay. I thought they'd, like, put him in carbonite or something.
Everyone's, like, not, partying like Jabba's Palace.
It's not the end of The Empire Strikes Back. Jabba the Hutt is not
Tony, it could be.
Oh, is this thing that's about almost ceiling height?
Yes. Have a look on their
website.
Yes,
I see it, yes.
Yeah. A lot of the paraphernalia, I believe, comes from cinemas in Aberdeen. But there's loads of posters and loads of old stuff. And it's what it is. It's really worth looking around. Really, really, really worth looking around. And they're lovely people. And I'm going back at the end of this week to try and somehow draw up a plan of the place, which might be interesting. Marcus Hearn has been to things there. That he knows them. They know him. And they very kindly agreed, because it's a day when they didn't have anything else on, and they do have a bar and they can do food. So they'll get some F&B receipts that they wouldn't otherwise. And it'll bring different sort of people into their museum who may, you know, if they get 3 or 4 or 5 people who are really interested and move on with that, then it's good for them. So I'm very grateful, really, 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 really grateful for what they're doing, because you don't get places for nothing nowadays. And it's no more than a 10-minute stroll from Elephant and Castle Station, so, and probably 15 minutes from Oval Station.
I don't think you've ever seen me strolling, Tony. Perhaps a half-hour hobble.
When I went there before Christmas, it was quite a hobble. And I'll probably have me stick with me on the day, just so I can smash Mark over the head with it.
Like Manuel the waiter.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I was watching the Hotel Inspectors the other day as part of my research for Bernard Cribbins, and that is just 34 minutes of genius, because it just slow burner in the last 5 minutes is just complete and utter farce. It's physical comedy at its absolute finest.
It might be the best episode of Fawlty Towers, the Hotel Inspector.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, until, and then the one after that's pretty decent as well, so. But no, I think the Hotel Inspector is probably my favourite, actually.
Well, Bernard's brilliant because he is a buffoon and a pompous arse, his character, Mr. Hutchinson. But it's just, when it develops, oh, it's just fantastic. There you go. I've been watching quite a few things with Bernardine. I was watching The Wrong Arm of the Law over the weekend, 1963 film, Peter Sellers, him and Lionel Jeffries and many others. That was good. Mm-hmm. Written by Colton and Simpson.
Oh. All right. I've got half hour.
Yeah, and Steptoe. Very, very entertaining film. Very entertaining film. But I digress.
Autograph opportunities as well?
Yes, there will be autograph opportunities. We're just finalising a price. It will not be excessive. And if anyone's listening to this podcast on the rare chance that they might be listening, they go, it's going to be cash only for autographs, because every penny from the autographs will go to Save the Children. We don't want to incur any fees. That's why when we sold the tickets, the booking fee Eventbrite charge, I think it was £3.71, was on top of the ticket price. I must say, all the guests are on expenses only, and quite a few have said to me that if they're in London, they're not going to claim expenses either. Really is that sort of thing.
I think we were quite fortunate, Mark. Did you ever meet him, Hayden?
What, Mark?
No, Terence.
Yes, of course he has. He's had a drink with him, haven't you?
He got me drunk.
Yes.
Of course! What am I talking about? Yes!
Do you want me to regale you with this story yet again?
Oh, Christ, no. I'll just say, Go on, then. As it's for Uncle Terence.
So, it was Time 5 in 2010, and it was my first convention, and it was just after I'd started writing for Celestial Toy Room. So I went there very nervous and quite shy.
Hold on, that's when I was editor. Do you mean to say that I gave you your first break?
Yeah, in fact, actually, you could say that everything from here on in, all the books, all of the writing for Goal.com, all of those matches I did for Eurosport, they're all your fault, Tony.
You monster.
Can I just apologise to the world? I remember that event because, I tell you, you probably don't remember that event. That was when I think Terence he was the first ever recipient of the Society's Outstanding Contribution to Doctor Who Award. And I presented him with it.
Oh, is that one of those curved glass?
Yeah. The first ever one. But my biggest memory of that day was that I was interviewing Padders on stage. And you know how steeply Riverside was sloped in the cinema?
Yeah.
And about halfway up, as I was looking up stage left, Terence was in the audience. He started asking questions. And I said, you want to come down here and do the interview, Terence? he was on fire that day, the man was.
He was indeed. He was. And he was sitting there with his wife and one of his sons. And I plucked up the courage to go over and say hello. And unfortunately, it was just as, I think it might have been Patrick White, was beckoning him to go up on stage. So Terence said, oh, don't worry, I'll come and find you after. So I felt a little bit sort of, oh no, I've missed my opportunity now. Terence Dix is never going to seek me out later and come and say hello. And I was speaking to Ian McLachlan at the bar, and all of a sudden Terence walks over. And just the three of us all start talking, and Terence says, oh, what are you drinking to me? And I was having an Aspel cider. I said, oh, just a cider, Terence. And cider, I mean, I don't drink it anymore because it's my real Achilles heel. He bought me... Definitely bought me one. I think he bought... Oh, no, he bought me more. Mike bought me a couple. And in return, I bought him a couple. And by then, I was pissed as a newt, and I ended up hugging Sylvester McCoy against his will during the photo shoot session.
Can I just ask you something? Where is Sylvester McCoy's will on his body?
I thought you were about to say, where is Sylvester McCoy now?
That was when I sat down next to him and I said to him, and I don't know why, I said, oh, you were the doctor when I was born. And he went, when you were born? How old are you then? And I think I was 21. He went, oh, 21, oh, I'm 3 times your age.
What accent is that meant to be, Hayden?
I think it's sort of Southern Ireland.
Terence was always incredibly generous with his time.
Oh, yes.
And I think, you know, he's one of those few people that was beloved by everyone. Just like Nick Courtney was, so Terence is. Like Katie Manning, the same. There's a very few people within the world of Doctor who are loved like that. And that is why, when he did pass away, the outpouring of love for him took, I know it absolutely took the family by surprise. They could not believe just how much people thought of him. And it came from around the globe.
It did. It really did. Well, he had such an important part in all of our lives. I mean, for me, certainly, it stretches beyond Doctor Who. Because, really, I don't think it's your fault, Tony, that I'm a writer. I think it's Terence's, really. And I'm sorry to completely leave it on his shoulders, of course. But, you know, it's I think that is the fact. You know, that Web of Fear target book was humongous in my development, you know, in what I wanted to do, got me into reading. And that was one of the biggest accolades that you could give to him, is he got an awful lot of people who arguably wouldn't have been interested in reading into literacy, yeah, and into writing, into reading, into prose, like you said earlier. You know, he was so influential in that. Of course, there were others. Of course, you know, there were likes of Ian Marter and Malcolm Hole. But it was Terence Dicks. It was the volume of the work that he did, not just on screen, but in prose form too.
Yeah, it's a real shame that he never got formally recognised for his contributions to children's literacy whilst he was alive, really, did he?
No.
I said to him that he should have got a knighthood for it, which he wholeheartedly agreed with.
Yes, that was only worth for his autograph, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, so do I.
This is the trouble, though. People like Terence, who influenced thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people, don't get the recognition that they deserve. At least, we're not putting it right, but we knew all along how much he was loved, because he was at the first ever Doctor Who convention, the legendary one in the Battersea Church Hall in August 1977. He was there from the start. He was part of fandom growing up. And went on for decades still to come. And no one ever got tired of seeing Terence or talking to him. No. You know, sometimes you can have guests who turn up far too often and it's not really worth it. Never with Terence, because he always had different anecdotes, different stories, different tales that would just come to him off the top of his head, depending on where the conversation was going. Fascinating man.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the last time I ever met him was at the Capital Three, I think, and he was sitting in the green room, and I went up to him and I said to him, and I said, oh, I remember the first time I met you, Terence, was in the bar at Hammersmith, and I got very drunk and so did you, and we talked for ages, but I don't suppose you remember what we spoke about, did you? And he said, no, of course I don't. No, I mean, it's...
dear. It's like he's with us today.
And in fact, when we were on our tribute podcast to Terence, when Hayden mentioned that he'd been the man who'd inspired him to start writing, we did wonder whether Terence had died or been assassinated.
The thing is, it's not just Hayden writes his prose. You probably know that over time I wrote 9 amateur dramatic pantomimes. I've never written a book, always thought I would, but it's never happened and it's not going to. But I've written so many articles for magazines over the decades, going back to school, and obviously edited CT and edited parish magazines and God knows what. And it's a love, it's a lifelong love of writing the English language. It's the English language is the key. It doesn't matter how you do it, though. Terence was very precise about how prose should be used. But it's just the English language is a wonderful thing and it should be utilised to the full, which it isn't very much nowadays, unfortunately.
No.
The key thing I've tried to get across, it's not about the guests. There's no photos of the guests going up. There's no photos of the guests going in the little souvenir brochure. There's photos of Terence and his family. It's 100% about Terence, and the guests will enable us to hear stories and talk about him and whatever. But they are, unlike at the Capitol or any other convention, the guests are secondary.
Mm.
They're facilitators so that we can learn as much as we want to, or we can hear about Terence in the day and celebrate what he was.
I'm glad that Barry's family are going to be there because
that's
one of the things I like best about Terence is that sort of, it's almost as if it's been written by Robert Holmes, isn't it? That double act between them. They're all, I mean, opposites in the sense that, you know, Terence was very much the outgoing.
He's the Henry Gordon Jago.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, exactly, yes.
Barry was the Professor Lightfoot. Chalk and cheese. I mean, it's perfect, isn't it? Opposites attract. And you think they worked together from towards the middle, second half of 69, then when they went off and did the classic serials together and all that.
Mm-hmm.
They worked together on time. And then, of course, Terence went on to actually produce the classic serials as well.
Yeah.
Those were the days.
Right. So, do we have anything else more to say about... Do you want to say a little brief things about the Capitol? I mean, I don't think there's much point going through, you know, in great detail, but...
Am I going to come back on at end of March, beginning of April?
Yes, I thought, well, if you'd like to.
Mm.
I noticed that on, was it today you put out that notice on the online about...
Oh, the housekeeping notice, yeah. The schedule is so full. I can't really run beyond 6:30 on the first day. The only way I could get more time is if we start before 10 o'clock. On both days, and we're not finishing till I reckon 6:15 on the Sunday. We're still chasing one or two more guests potentially. We've still got a couple more guests confirmed that we've got to announce, and there's lots and lots of other things. The thing that I'm particularly pleased about is how the Space Museum is coming together. There's going to be some really lovely things in there. Very unusual. It was a concept I came up with, and now we've got the JNT photo collection that I'm curating. There's about 90 photos I've selected for that. There is the Museum of Classic Sci-Fi coming down with the gastropod and various other things. There are the recently announced Anthony Ainley letters between himself and this American fan, Denise, between 1985 and 1992. And they're worth looking at because some of them are written on the back of scripts. Some of them he's put little stickers on or whatever. Fascinating. And you've got my archive collection as well. And there's other things still to be announced. So it's going to be a proper little exhibition of things that people have never seen before. So that's coming together very nicely. I'm really pleased with it. And that's, I think you know me, guys, that I always try and get different sort of things at the Capitol. After the first one, second, the Alec Wheel collection, didn't we?
Yeah.
The third one, we had the TARDIS consult room from Sharda. And last year we had the Asylum of the Daleks and, of course, the legendary lift shaft of the Daleks.
That was extraordinary.
Yeah.
These are all add-ons that don't actually that cost us, but I think they make it just that little bit different for
definitely.
All the people who come along. And that what sets us apart from everyone else, I believe. My aim, as always, is just to give the maximum I can value for money, remembering, of course, that we're not-for-profit and we're trying to raise money for charities.
How's the hotel been?
Had lots of meetings down there already. So far, so good. We've got an exec meeting there the week before the event, and then that'll really be it. So that's why I wanted to get as much in place as possible. And they're certainly seeming to work for us. It's what I would say, it's very different to the Aurora, and yet it's very similar. The configuration of the rooms is different. It doesn't obviously have the massive waterfall and things like that.
Oh, well, that might help our recording interviews.
It has other things that work quite nicely, I think. And people will once people see the layout, they will recognise it because there's a lobby area before you go into what will be the main panopticon bit. And that's where last year, that's where the artists and model makers will be. So that's quite similar. And we're going to be having a system of one-way system so that you'll go in one door to the panopticon, you'll come out of another. And as you come out, that takes you out to where all the dealers are. And we've got a much bigger dealer presence this year, much bigger, utilising all three parts of the secondary main suite to create that. And it's going to be good having Eagle Moss there because they'll be there with all sorts of their models and things. Yeah, there's some very regular members of the Capitol community who'll be there, like Galaxy 4, but there'll be people there for the first time. That's going to be good. Again, not all these artists are the same. We've got one or two new artists as well. So it's nice. Robin Pritchard has got a much, much bigger photo studio as well, by the way. So that should allow for different things as well.
Anything particularly you're looking forward to, especially this year?
In what terms of what?
Is there anything sort of like, shall we say, a sort of Stephen Burkoff moment that you're particularly looking forward to?
Well, the one interview I'm doing this year is Lord Bernard of Cribbins.
Oh, wonderful.
I'm starting to try and develop my equivalent of the Glastonbury Sunday afternoon legends slot. Here's some research. You know what? I do like to do my research. Winter of 1963 was the worst weather, snowiest, blah, 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 since 1740-something, yeah? Mm. Basically, the snow came just before Christmas 62 and didn't go until early March 63. And in the charts, officially dated the 9th of January 1963, number 25 in the charts was Mr. Bernard Cribbins with Gossip Calypso. One place above him at number 24 were a young beat combo from Merseyside with their first song in the charts called Love Me Do. Yes, it was the Beatles. There was Bernard propping up the Beatles by one position.
God, and look where they ended up, eh?
Yeah.
That wasn't unusual in the 60s, was it? You had people like Ken Dodd at number one, didn't you, with Happiness? And
Yeah.
Des O'Connor as well, wasn't it?
You'll actually remember this, Tony, whereas we won't, but...
Yeah, absolutely. The thing is, the change of music between 62, 63, and every year, it was totally new. It was incredible. It was worth listening to.
I'll tell you what highlights that. The Doctor Who years 60s video, which you've showed, I think, every year, that you can get it from that, 63 through to 69. The music landscape has changed completely within that decade. I don't think there's any other decade before or since where music has evolved so much over such a short period of time. But then again, that's drugs for you.
Now, all you have to do is actually look at the Beatles from 62 to 69.
Mm.
They reinvented themselves at least half a dozen times. At least. It's quite extraordinary. So they were a microcosm of the entire generation.
Mm.
I don't think the Stones changed, but they didn't change in a way the Beatles did. And rather like in the 90s, it was Oasis or Blur. In the mid-60s, it was the Beatles or the Stones, the Beatles being the softer option. That was how things went. It was wonderful. And I can remember the mid-60s onwards, Doc.
So what's the earliest Doctor Who story you remember then?
Physically remembering the Web Planet, for sure.
Oh, wow. Crikey.
And the chase.
Oof.
Well, I would have been... 5 when the Web Planet was on.
Oh, wow.
I believe I watched it from Doctor Who from the start. But Web Planet, absolutely. The Chase, very happy memories of, terrified memories of Power of the Daleks as well. What Terence said when I was interviewing him one time with Derek Sherwin about the 60s was so true. Now, everyone, I might have said this before, but everyone goes about Marco Polo and that's what they wanted.
Mm.
I hated the historicals. I found them boring as anything. And Terence's opinion on stage once many years ago was that the kids didn't want the historicals. They said, "F Marco Polo, it's the Daleks we want." He said that on stage. And it's so, so true.
It's true when you're a kid, isn't it? Yeah.
Absolutely.
It is, because I think I said a couple of podcasts back, I was talking to my friend's daughter who likes Doctor Who. I was saying, I think tonight's episode is one of those historical ones. And she just pulled her face as if I'd just given her a plate full of Brussels sprouts.
But, yeah, the reason the Daleks were on so much is because we bloody loved them, you know. You couldn't get enough Daleks. And that's why the Web Planet was cool, because it was all these different strange creatures. That was an absolute tripping story, that.
I love the Web Planet.
Yeah, it's got such a bad reputation.
Well... Uncle Terence has left a hole in our hearts almost as big as the hole in the library shelf that Hayden left when he first took out their Web of Fear book and never returned it.
But Debbie Watling said it was fine because I'd written my name on it, so it was mine now. those were her words to that 9-year-old boy back in the 90s. So,
right.
Did you want me to bring something along for the Whoseum today?
Well, I was going to say, we've got another 25 minutes left. Shall we finish off with that? So let's take the dumbwaiter lift up to the ground floor of the Whoseum. Can you all squeeze in?
Budge up a bit.
Come on. Oh, totally. This is not built for someone as tall as Tony, okay?
Hayden, watch out for my coccyx, please.
Okay, send us up. Here we are. Computer, could you open the doors to the Hoosium exhibition hall, please? Tony, what have you brought us for exhibition at the Hoosium? This is not unconnected with Uncle Terence himself, I understand.
No, it is not. I have especially, and this is why I had such a strong guard, because people would steal it. They would just take it away. I have brought my own personal first edition paperback piccolo copy of The Making of Doctor Who by Mac Halk and Terence Dix. Dates back to 1972. Still got it. Shrink wrap, I have it.
First edition.
Jammy. And it's in just about perfect edition. If you want to make a sort of perfect symmetry, I can also give you, for temporary loan, my 1976 Making of Doctor Who Target reprint, first edition.
Ah, is that the one with an illustration of Tom Baker's face on the front cover?
Mm-hmm.
On top of it's like a...
Yeah, on top of a basically on top of the Target.
Oh, yes, I had that, yeah.
So I have both.
I do have an extremely battered copy of the original one, but it's falling apart. This looks a lot better.
So did you actually buy this at the time, Tony? Or were you giving it at the time? Or was it something you've acquired since?
Bought both of them at the time. Absolutely. Pocket money. It's like the Target books when they started coming out. They were 25p each. So pocket money saved. Used to head down to Ealing Broadway on the 83 bus on Saturdays, go to W.H. Smith and see what was in there. And then they went up to 30p. I was gutted at that.
That's inflation for you.
Yeah. Mm. Of course, those original Targets are not worth anything because they were printed in such number and so many sold because they were so popular. That's why you end up with something like The Wheel in Space being worth money, because it was printed in the late 80s and very few copies were made.
Mm. It's an intriguing book. I mean, I had a little flick through over the weekend, and there's an awful lot of, I suppose it's the age of the show at that point. It feels as though there's an awful lot of the lore being written within this book. Like, you've got accounts from the prosecution and the defence from the Doctor's trial in the War Games written in there, and his name written in scientific letters. And I was very impressed by it, actually. I was very impressed.
I have a feeling that the Piccolo one tended to perpetuate the myth that, I think does it say in the Piccolo one that only about 2 million people watched the opening episode? He said that's more people than watched Shakespeare in his lifetime, whatever. That wasn't the case. There was this myth that the worst viewing figures ever for a Doctor Who story were one of the episodes of the Gunfighters. And I think actually that wasn't correct. And these sort of tales, shall we say, or whatever it was, they came out of things like this, because quite frankly, when they were putting this book together, they wouldn't have done the research. They wouldn't have known it was before fandom existed, effectively.
Yeah.
Although fandom existed in every little home who watched it, but there was no such thing as an organised fandom. Even the Doctor Who fan club hadn't started, I don't think, then. So it's like I started recording audios of Doctor Who from season 11, so from the time onwards. Thinking I was probably, because I had a Prinztronic cassette tape player recorder, so I would tape them then, and I thought I must be the only person in the world who was doing this by putting the microphone right in front of the speaker in front of the telly. It's no subtlety. But fortunately, C30 tapes, you would get Doctor Who on quite nicely on each side.
So this was in your childhood then, Tony?
Yeah, I would have been 14 when I started recording Doctor Who.
Surely it would be reel-to-reel, wouldn't it?
No. I got a Prinztronic tape recorder, and I think I got it for my birthday in 73, by which time season 10 was just about ending. So, yeah. I do remember one thing. In one episode of season 11, which was obviously during the miners' strike of 74 and the power cuts and all that, power got cut during one of the episodes of Doctor Who. Terrible. And I think there was another time when the meter ran out, so I had to kind of find a shilling and put it in there.
Well, I used to record the videos I got from the library onto my Talkboy, and that would be holding the Talkboy up to the grill of the telly and then listening back to it that evening. I'll tell you what, chaps, Planet of Fire is a slog when you've only got the audio to listen to.
I have to tell you, quite a lot of Monster of Peladon is a slog, even when you watch it, let alone when you just do
the audio. Yeah, I was going to say, and we've seen it, yeah. There's a lovely bit in here where they write about the regulars, the cast regulars during this period. And they write about John Levine, and it's... This paragraph reads as though, I reckon John Levine probably read this, thought, well, hang on a minute, you've not actually been very nice to me here. You've rather played down the role that I play within this whole operation. So they've added a little bit at the end, which seems slightly incongruous. But anyway, I'll read it out to you. It says, John Levine, he plays Sergeant Benson. He did not go to RADA. In fact, he had no formal training to become an actor. He started as an extra, which means he only appeared as one of a crowd and had no lines to say. He worked his way up from there, learning as he went. Playing Sergeant Benson is his first big television part, and frankly, he is delighted about it. If the script is too long, he jokes, it's always my lines that they cut out. Still, sometimes when the script has been too short, they have thought of me and made my part bigger to make up the time. As Sergeant Benson, he gets a lot of fan mail. Once, the entire female staff of a Lancashire factory wrote to tell him how much they liked him. Yeah, right.
The greatest ever thing, in my view, that Terence did was when Day of the Daleks episode 1 was running short and he wrote the Rank Has Its Privileges piece, gave work Richard, John and Katie. You know, we reenacted it at the first ever Capitol. Less than a 1 minute scene took about 8.5 minutes. That's the genius of it. That was the genius of Terence Dicks in a nutshell. He was underrunning. He came up. He couldn't spend a penny on anything else. Mm. Came up with Rank Has Its Privileges. Just shows you how his mind worked. He was just a brilliant, brilliant man.
He was indeed.
I did like the photos in the centre of the book. I mean, they're not anything amazing, but I can imagine in 72, you see that you'd...
Well, the image of Hartnell isn't anything that you'd think of, you know, with the specs and the hat on.
It doesn't actually look like him, does it?
That's from Unearthly Child, isn't it? Or from the pilot, even.
Yeah, I was thinking that's from the pilot. Yeah, they're like the specs he wears in this Sporting Life. It's like a weird amalgamation of the two roles.
Is that the first place where the quote about, if I live to be 90, a little bit Doctor Who, that's the place where it first came from, wasn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah.
I did wonder whether he actually said that or they might have made it up.
Because by this point he was quite ill, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was heading downhill.
Yeah.
I never know whether that was apocryphal, whether Terence or Mac were making that up.
So which of them is it a quote from?
The original making of Doctor Who. Maybe one of them might have come up with it because, I don't know, they might not have. But we know that's where you can date the quote being in print back to.
Yeah.
April 72, I think it was, printed, published, wasn't it?
How can they just make things up? Do you know, I have got no time for people like that. These sort of fantasists who sort of live in, you know, a bubble of their own inventions and think it's okay to, you know, deny reality like that. I tell you one thing, people like that will not get invited to the museum. They won't even get past the floor mosaics in the atrium. And they'll certainly never get the chance of travelling in the secret graveyard lift beneath the tombstone of Sir Jasper. No way. No way.
It's intriguing that at this point there still isn't like an overall title for the stories. I know obviously there had been on screen since The Savages onwards, but I mean, in the index here for the stories, you've just got the code, the writers, the directors and the enemies.
Well, the trouble is that the 10th anniversary Radio Times special merely perpetuated that.
Yeah.
So the first, the chase is called The Executioners. 5,000 Dawns. You know, you get all the first titles from, so Dalek Invasion of Earth is World's End.
Yeah, The Lion, I think, is a crusade, isn't it? I think from
the correct. Yeah, yeah. And it's sometime after that, oh my God, do you know what? For so many years, was an unearthly child. An unearthly child, was it? 100,000 BC, was it? Oh, God almighty. it went on until we then got to unit dating with Mordred Undead. That's when it all went completely tits up. Because Pyramids of Mars was 1980, and yet the Brigadier is retired in Mordred. He's a teacher in 1977, isn't he?
I mean, the Daleks was quite a long time referred to as the Mutants, wasn't it, that second story?
Yep. Yeah. Which, incredible, really, isn't it?
Mark, do you want to get a word in there, Rachel? Are you happy to rest on your laurels of your two-word monster remark?
No, I'm okay. Sorry. I was just having a look at the book, and I was quite enjoying Terence's attempt to explain why the TARDIS is bigger on the inside than it is on the outside.
I had to have a lie down after reading that.
Yes. Here is a four-dimensional box in three dimensions. It is a two-dimensional projection of a three-dimensional projection of a four-dimensional cube. Oh, what? Well, that's made everything much clearer.
Interestingly, that explanation, I asked us to understand it by imagining how the TARDIS would seem to a civilization of two-dimensional beings.
Yes.
Who he refers to as the Flatlanders.
Mm.
Which is, interestingly, I wonder if that partly inspired the title of Flatline.
Yes, I wondered about that.
I have my doubts, you know.
I think the stuff about what it's like in a television studio reminds me very much of Malcolm Hulk's book, Writing for Television, which is very much, it's almost like explaining to a novice TV writer what sort of things they need to take into consideration if they wanted one of their scripts to pass muster. That reminds me very much of that. My favourite bit of all is a large chunk of the book is made up by this fictional record to the Doctor's trial, aren't they, where they have the evidence for the defence, evidence for the prosecution, and then the evidence for defence is effectively an excuse to give really a potted history of all the Doctor's adventures, isn't it? His Doctor's called Delta Cubed Sigma Chi Squared, isn't he? Which, by a staggering coincidence, was also the telephone number of an Islington flat where Mark once went to a very good party and met a very nice girl whom he entirely failed to get off with.
This is beginning to sound like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
But I can imagine, and I'm sure you did, Tony, I can imagine you poring over that book endlessly when you were that age. The way we did with the Doctor Who Monster books that Terence produced later, when we were little.
I still have the Doctor Who Monster book with the big poster inside it unopened.
Of course, yes.
Still only worth about 2 and 6 pence farthing, but there you go.
Interestingly, I was looking for that on my shelves for that tonight, for that Matt Hulk Writing for Television book. I don't know what I've done with it. And I came across Doctor Who, The Unfolding Text. I don't remember buying that.
What's his name?
John Tulloch and Manuel Alvarado?
Yeah.
Is that worth reading?
That was one of the first how can we put it?
Academic?
Yes, academic works. Closely followed thereafter by Gary Downey's Doctor Who cookbook. That was another academic work.
So I must have bought it on eBay or something a while ago, but I tried to work out why I never read it. I was sitting on the loo about half an hour before we started this, and I opened it up at random. The first sentence I saw was, Graham Williams's intertextual dependency was to define his role as producer. I thought, oh, that's why I didn't read it. Right, we shall place your first edition in one of our hermetically sealed special book display cases.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Right, well, Terence, sorry. Tony.
Yes, mate.
Mark and I will be attending the Terence event on the 15th of March, which I look forward to seeing you there.
Yeah.
Hayden.
Oh, no, yeah.
Hayden, the fool, can't come because he's going to be doing a 10,000-metre run.
10-kilometre run?
10 kilometres or 10,000 metres, whichever is longer.
Which I suspect he may still finish before I manage to make it from Elephanton Castle Tube to the location.
Oh. Do you know what? I was absolutely crestfallen when I saw the date of that. If it had been the day before, I could have made it. But yeah, unfortunately, I bought this ticket just before Christmas and I can't back out.
Well, I'm still making it up to the boys, Tony, because on the day before, when they've got the talents event at the BFI...
Oh, yeah.
I browbeat them both into confirming that they're going to attend. And I went on the morning that the tickets went on sale. assuming, because I'm a member, I'll be able to buy as a member before they go on sale to the general public. Opened it up, and it was already sold out. I got my dates wrong. Because we were thinking, of just in case there were any, you know, anti-racist protests outside the BFI that day. We were thinking of going in yellow face. And if anyone complained, just saying, excuse me, we're jaundice sufferers.
Oh, that should be good.
And we would have got away with it too.
Big Fiddy organises those events, and he'll be at, as far as I'm aware, he'll be at the Terence event as well.
Oh, wonderful.
Right. In that case, Tony, I understand that your Zill limousine is, the engine's running outside the front door. So we'll spirit you away into it. I think we're managing to keep the crowds at bay behind the crash barriers. So we'll just check if everything's calmed down outside. Computer, could you open the front door, please? I think we'll give it a few more minutes. We might send Tony's car round to the side door, actually.
Has your electric charging station given me a 100% battery life?
It has indeed. Yes, we plugged Tony in the moment he sat down.
I need the charging, not the car.
So, we shall see you in 3 weeks. We shall also see you sometime after that on the podcast to talk at greater length about the oncoming Capital 5 event. And until then, oh, it's the Sons of Scar of Daleks. Have you got a message for us?
Emergency regulations. Please do not dump babies into the river.
Dalek Ray, we have mechanoid ships in Sector 27.
It's a trap!
Right, Tony's just slipping quietly out of one of our side doors now, trying to avoid the crowds. Bye, Tony. Thank you for presenting this wonderful first edition. We promise we will treasure it forever in one of our high-security display cases. Bye, Tony.
All right, see you, mate. Bye.
Is he gone? Oh,
hey! Woohoo! A first edition, a mink edition first edition.
Oh, brilliant. Mark, pass over the yellow pages, would you?
Here you go.
Thank you. Now, bookstores.
Good old yellow pages.
Oh, God, not that voice. Please, take it away.
Here we are. Try them, will you, Mark?
Hello? Is that the rare bookshop in the square? Ah. Do you buy and sell? Oh, excellent. Could you tell me if you have any first editions of The Making of Doctor Who by Malcolm Hulk and Terence Dix? You do? Oh, that's wonderful. How much is it worth these days? I'll be along as soon as possible. My name? Well, yes, it's J.R.
Mark. Better give it a false name.
Southall.
Oh, we're quids in. We can finally afford that Henry Moore bronze of Adric's erection. Computer, mood music, please. Bye-bye, listeners.
Bye.
Till next time.
Send 4.
Bye.
We're in the money. We've got a lot of what it takes to get along. We're in the money, the sky is sunny. Old Man Depression, you are through, you done us wrong. Oh, we never see headline about red line today. And when we see the landlord, we can look that guy right in the eye. Oh, we're in the money, come on, my honey. Let's lend it, spend it, send it rolling around.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at DiddlyDum, on Twitter at Diddly_Dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum, meaty, not runny. Top breeders recommend it because it's solid nourishment for the ears.